Come now to oral questions. First in the name of Nancy Liu.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has she seen about the economy?
Mr. Speaker, yesterday I saw that the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee agreed to leave the official cash rate at 5.5%. The committee noted that consumer price inflation is currently above the 1-3% target range and that a restrictive monetary policy stance remains necessary at this time to bring inflation back within the band.
Supplementary. When will inflation be back within the 1-3% target?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand has had a cost of living crisis in recent years, with inflation being over 7% for most of 2022. Inflation has been falling since then, and the Monetary Policy Committee is confident that inflation will return to within the 1-3% band in this calendar year. That is also consistent with the economic outlook Treasury published alongside the budget policy statement 2 weeks ago.
Supplementary. Can fiscal policy have an inflationary impact?
Mr. Speaker, yes. Strong growth in government spending can have an inflationary impact when the economy is operating above capacity and interest rates are restrictive. Recent history gives us a very salient example of exactly that. The issue of the interaction between fiscal policy and monetary was discussed at the recent Monetary Policy Committee meeting. On the basis of the forecasts and the half-year update and the commitments outlined by the government in the recent budget policy statement, the committee noted that government spending is expected to decline as a share of the economy.
Supplementary. Has the battle against inflation been won?
Mr. Speaker, no, I would not say that. While the Reserve Bank is making progress in the battle against inflation, it still currently remains outside the target band, and further work is required to keep future inflation near the 2% midpoint. In the budget policy statement, the government signalled a policy of ongoing fiscal consolidation to bring revenue and expenses back into balance, and also to support monetary policy to bring inflation within target and maintain it there. We want to see inflation continuing to come down so that interest rates can eventually follow them, giving New Zealanders cost of living relief and allowing the economy to start growing again.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Can she confirm that she told the Finance and Expenditure Committee this morning that the government would be borrowing more in future, and how much is the government intending to borrow?
The Honourable Nicola Willis.
Mr. Speaker, no, I did not say that. I've checked the transcripts, and as has become a habit from this member, she has paraphrased me in a way that is inaccurate. She also, when we read the transcript, find that the reason she may not have heard my actual words is that she was interrupting continuously. In fact, what the case is that what I said was, yes, we will be borrowing. That should not... In fact, what I said was that, yes, we would be borrowing. That should not be a revelation to the minister, to the member, because since the dawn of time, governments have borrowed in order to finance their activities. If the member wants information about the bond issuance that the government is doing over the forecast period and wants to learn a bit more about how that works, she can go to the half-year economic and fiscal update on page 45, where it outlines those intentions.
Really unappealing.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary.
Just wait for your friends to quiet down.
Would the borrowing for day-to-day costs, as confirmed by the Minister of Finance and Expenditure Select Committee today, be higher or lower if she had not restored interest deductibility and was not pursuing her tax cut package?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this government has set a clear goal of having net core crown debt reduce as a proportion of GDP. In stark contrast with other members in this House, including the one who just asked a question, who said that she would be comfortable with debt increasing. Right. So, Mr. Speaker, the position we have is a member opposite who is concerned suddenly about structural deficits. And what I would point out to her is that if the government continued the pattern of extraordinary, ineffective spending that has been the case in recent years, the structural deficit and therefore borrowing would have to grow considerably. I can also say, Mr. Speaker, I am trying to help the member with the answer to the question. I can also say, Mr. Speaker, that we have committed to a lower operating allowance than that committed to by the previous government.
Supplementary. Does she accept that if she did not restore interest deductibility or pursue tax cuts, debt would at least be $11 billion lower with all things being equal?
Well, Mr. Speaker, with all things being equal, we would be continuing to plough billions more dollars into wasteful programs. And the deal we did with New Zealanders was this. We said we're going to spend their money more effectively. We're going to reduce the amount of money on back office bureaucracy. We're going to stop subsidies for private firms to decarbonise. And we're going to take those savings and we're going to invest them in tax relief. And what the member now wants the House to accept is that we would do one without the other. And actually, if she's saying that Labor's suddenly woken up and thinks savings are a good idea, then what a great revelation that is.
Supplementary,
Mr. Honourable
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Does she accept that ANZ senior economist Miles Workman is correct, that there is a counterfactual that if the government did not deliver those tax cuts and cut spending as it says it will, it would offset the economic drivers of higher debt as reported in Stuff?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have seen the ANZ's response to the budget policy update, in which it identified that the fiscal track and the approach being taken by the incoming government is more restrictive on spending than the last government.
Supplementary. Yeah. How can she possibly say that she is not borrowing to pay for her tax package when she confirmed to FEC today that ultimately it is all funded from the same place?
Because I am not borrowing for our tax package. Because, Mr. Speaker, what we are doing is they either want the answer or they don't, I guess.
Supplementary. Does she agree with Nicola Willis, who promised to achieve a surplus in 2026-27, reduce government debt by $3.4 billion compared with PREFU, not borrow for tax cuts, not cut frontline services and introduce no new taxes, and are there any promises she doesn't intend to break?
Mr. Speaker, not only do I agree that we will keep our commitments, what I also agree is that it is a very good thing that this government was elected. Because if it weren't, we would be continuing as a country down a path of deepening structural deficit, of escalating debt, of wasteful spending and high inflation, and I am so glad that the adults are back in charge.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Chris Bishop.
Supplementary to the Minister of Finance. What reports has she received about alternative approaches to borrowing and debt?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have seen a report from Radio New Zealand that said that Labor's finance spokesperson Barbara Edmonds said a future Labor government would consider taking on more debt.
I know that today is the last day of a long sitting block, but that sort of rabble is... Sorry. No one's gone from the House yet, but they may well be close. Could I call on question number 3 from Tania Unkovich?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Agriculture.
Just a minute. Okay, carry on.
My question is to the Associate Minister of Agriculture. What recent announcements has he made?
Honourable Mark Patterson.
Speaker,
In line with recent announcements, on Monday, myself alongside Minister McClay and local Wairarapa MP Mike Buttrick embarked upon our first of our nationwide woolshed meetings in the Wairarapa. We met with a significant turnout. Not only will we be outlining government plans and priorities, we will be also seeking feedback. This government is actually committed to listening to our farmers, primary sector and rural communities. Over the next few months, we will be undertaking over 20 of these meetings from Northland through to Southland. Of special interest to me is seeking input in relation to reviving the New Zealand strong wool sector.
Supplementary question. What engagements has he had with the sector?
Mr. Speaker, recently I convened a meeting of key industry leadership. These individuals came from both the commercial sector and, crucially, within farming leadership. This is a group that has for far too long had their views poorly canvassed. From this meeting, I have tasked this group with establishing a pathway to a united and recognised industry voice. They are also tasked with exploring alternative pathways to market capable of delivering much higher returns back behind the farm gate.
Supplementary question. What other actions has he taken? Is he taking?
Mr. Speaker. Next week I'm taking New Zealand wool to the world. I will be leading a delegation of New Zealand wool manufacturing businesses to the International Wool Organisation Textile Conference in Adelaide. We aim to capitalise on the significant increased trend back towards natural and sustainable fibres. These end uses span from traditional carpets and upholstery to exciting new innovations like 3D printed acoustics and pigments from walls broken down into the component parts. Only by increasing demand in high value end uses will we lift returns to our farmers.
Supplementary question. What benefit will this bring?
Mr. Speaker.
Just wait a minute.
This is the first time, actually, that New Zealand wool has been specifically featured at the IWTO. It is quite a big deal. This represents a significant opportunity to showcase the attributes of New Zealand wool and the innovation of New Zealand's wool manufacturing capability to a large international audience. I am determined that the New Zealand wool sector will make a significant contribution to deliver on the Coalition Government's agreement of doubling our exports in the next decade.
Supplementary, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, why did he and his colleagues remove ministerial oversight of the Overseas Investment Office that will mean that more farms go into foreigners' hands for the planting of pine trees?
Just a minute. I mean, there's been a lot of comment my way about the appropriateness of answers to questions, but similarly, questions should relate to the
point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Well, you can have your point of order while I'm finished. The question was, what recent announcements has he made? If you're asking about what they have done, that may not be a recent announcement.
It was a recent announcement.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
In that case, we'll carry on. Ask a question again.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister and his colleagues, why was there a recent announcement that ministerial oversight of the Overseas Investment Office would be removed, which means more farms will be sold to foreigners to be planted in pine trees?
That's speculation on the member's part, but I would invite the member to address the question to Minister Pink, who is the relevant minister.
Question number four. Larne Farm.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment and asks, does she agree with advice from officials in the Our Land 2024 report that, quote, an extractive approach to land reduces nature's ability to sustain itself and provide for us, putting our economy and livelihoods, food system resilience, natural ecosystems and quality of life at risk? If not, why not?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Penny Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the member for her question. I agree that we need to care for our land and our natural ecosystems. This government absolutely believes that taking a balanced approach is necessary to best support our economy and livelihoods, food system resilience, natural ecosystems and quality of life.
Supplementary. Is she concerned that extractive industries will soon be able to bypass the environmental protections in New Zealand law, including the Resource Management Act, the Wildlife Act, the Conservation Act and the Exclusive Economic Zone Act through the government's proposed fast-track process?
Mr. Speaker, the fast-track consenting bill is before the Select Committee at this time, and so it would be inappropriate for me to make any comment on that.
Because it always has been.
Supplementary. What advice, if any, was she invited to provide to Cabinet on the environmental risks of allowing extractive industries to fast-track projects which are likely to harm natural ecosystems?
Mr. Speaker, I know that the member is very interested in the report and the data that is in the report, and absolutely policies and decisions that we will be making in the future will be informed by the data and the information that is in this report.
Supplementary. Is she concerned that having a Minister for the Environment outside Cabinet and no Environmental Cabinet Committee means that considerations about the environmental impact of laws and policies are not being given proper weight in the government's decision making?
No, Mr. Speaker, I'm not. And as a government, we are absolutely committed to protecting the resources. And this simply shows that we have a range of ministers that are interested in environmental factors. And we will be taking an evidence-based approach to our decision-making. And so we welcome this report and the data that's within it that will inform our decisions going forward. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary. Is she concerned that she has been left out of the decision-making process in the government's fast-track approvals bill, despite other ministers being given the power to override legislation that is her ministerial responsibility?
Not at all, Mr. Speaker. I've been very involved in the process and we are consulting widely, and as we work together as a cabinet, I've said that there is a wide range of ministers who have important interest in the environment, and I'm pleased to be one adding to those voices.
Question number five, in the name of the Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker, what advice has she received from the Ministry for Social Development that informed the government target of reducing job seeker benefits by 50,000 by 2030?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Louise Upson.
I've received lots of advice from MSD to inform the ambitious target of ensuring more New Zealanders reap the rewards and opportunities a job provides. Right. It's not possible to go through all the advice and the time to answer an oral question, including advice about the substantial increase in job seeker benefit recipients over recent years and how the target means reversing this trend.
Mr. Speaker, did the Ministry for Social Development recommend the target of 50,000? And if not, who did?
Mr. Speaker, a number of scenarios have been looked at in terms of coming up with a target. We've balanced it with being really ambitious in terms of supporting the number of people into employment, and I'm really proud to have landed on 50,000.
Mr. Speaker, will those on job seeker support health condition disability be excluded from the proposed 50,000 reduction? If not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, all job seekers deserve the same opportunities to get support and service to focus them on the rewards that work provides. We don't discriminate. We want to use every single day that is available to support people towards work.
Mr. Speaker, how does she intend to reduce the amount of people on JobSeeker support work ready by nearly 50% at a time when unemployment is expected to rise?
Mr. Speaker, I accept that we're in really challenging economic conditions that we have inherited as a government, but I don't shy away from the fact that every person who is either on JobSeeker benefit now or may lose a job in the coming weeks and months ahead, MSD, the welfare system, will be far more active in supporting people to be ready for work or in work.
Mr. Speaker, will the reduction of 50,000 beneficiaries be purely based on those who exit into work, or will they also include those who exit because they go to prison, move overseas, change relationship status, reach age of eligibility for superannuation, or sadly, die? And if all of the above, why does she keep saying the target is about supporting people into work?
Mr. Speaker, we have nearly 190,000 people today on the JobSeeker benefit. This government is absolutely and deliberately focused on supporting people into employment, and the way we measure success is to have 50,000 fewer people on the JobSeeker benefit by 2030. It won't be easy, but it is a challenge that this government embraces because we know the opportunities that having a job provides.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker, I need to know whether
point
or not
of order.
Mr. Speaker, I want to know whether or not the exits of 50,000 or reduced number of 50,000 beneficiaries.
This is not the way to get the answer.
Well, I don't think that she addressed the question, Mr. Speaker.
Well,
do you want me to explain why or no?
Well, the problem always is that people asking a question may not get the answer they want, but then to explain why the answer they wanted hasn't been given is not part of the standing orders arrangements. So what I will do is, much as I've looked at another question I was asked to yesterday, I will look at the Hansards and make a call on that from that point. But I'll tell
Thank
you what, to be fair and reasonable, have a supplementary that doesn't come off your list.
Okay. Mr. Speaker, will the reduction of 50,000 beneficiaries be purely based on those who exit benefit into work?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think I can be any clearer. This is about those who are currently on the Job Seeker Support benefit, not main benefits, Job Seeker Support. We want to see 50,000 fewer people receiving the Job Seeker benefit support by the year 2030.
Question. Yep. Question number six, the name of Joseph
Moody. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing. What recent announcements has he made on steps to improve the rental market?
Mr. Speaker, today I've announced changes to the Residential Tenancies Act to encourage landlords back into the rental property market. We are reintroducing 90-day no-cause terminations for periodic tenancies, returning landlords' notice periods for ending a tenancy to 42 days in certain circumstances, and we are reintroducing landlords' ability to give notice to end a fixed-term tenancy at the end of a term without giving a reason. Mr. Speaker, we know that waging a war on landlords just ends in pain for tenants, part of the reason why rents have gone up by $170 a week. In the last few years, we want to bring balance back to the rental market and bring landlords back into the market.
Supplementary. How will reinstating 90-day no-cause terminations improve conditions for renters?
Well, Mr. Speaker, over the last few years, we have heard from many landlords that without the backstop of 90-day no-cause terminations, they're just unwilling to take a chance on tenants who might have otherwise missed out on the rental market. People leaving prison, for example, people with criminal records, or people at the edges of the rental property market. Giving landlords the backstop of being able to end a tenancy will mean landlords meaning more of them giving people a fair go with the reassurance that if things don't work out, they can end the tenancy.
Supplementary. What will these changes mean for Queenstown?
Mr. Speaker, very positive changes for Queenstown. One of the effects of the 2020 changes to the Residential Tenancies Act to basically make the ending of a fixed-term tenancy almost automatically roll over to a periodic tenancy was the complete reduction in the number of landlords being able to being willing to offer short-term rentals in a market like Queenstown. Instead, landlords decided it was all too hard, and instead those properties ended on Airbnb, actually, which has contributed to people sleeping in tents down by the foreshore in Queenstown and other cases of hardship. I'm also advised, Mr. Speaker, that there are other holiday hotspots where this happens, including Waiheke Island and places like Dunedin with the student rental property. Yeah, well, I just mentioned Waiheke is exactly the point I'm making. So we are going to change that law back to what it was, which will mean that fixed-term tenancies mean fixed-term.
Supplementary.
Tamitha Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can he guarantee that whānau won't be kicked out of rental homes and the neighbourhoods that they're connected to as a result of the policies that he has announced today?
Well, Mr. Speaker, no minister can guarantee anything in Parliament, as that member knows. But what I would say is landlords don't kick out good tenants.
Just waiting.
What else is the government doing to fix the housing crisis?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government has a five-point plan to fix the housing crisis. We need improvements to the rental market to make it easier to be a landlord and to be a tenant. But most fundamentally, we need to smash the urban limits that are holding our cities back, fix infrastructure settings, and introduce incentives for cities and regions to go for growth. My colleague, Minister Chris Penk, is working on building and construction changes. We are going to deliver better social housing, and most importantly, we are going to fundamentally reform the RMA 1991, where the last government failed, Mr. Speaker. We will succeed.
Speaker.
Hang on. I get to call first. Oh. The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Media and Communication. Does she stand by her statement media plays a very, very important role in our democracy? And if not, why not?
Yes, the media provides an important role in disseminating information and content for the benefit of New Zealand. I'd like to take this opportunity to actually say it has been a deeply distressing time for many journalists, production staff and long-standing members of the media community this week, and my deepest sympathies lie with them and their families as they navigate this situation.
Speaker, why, given that statement and the unfolding crisis in the media sector, is there nothing for the media sector in the government's full second quarter action plan?
The impact on the commercial decisions made by TVNZ and News Hub and other media operators across New Zealand is incredibly sad, and I want to acknowledge how much distressing time it is for everyone involved. I'm focused on helping the industry modernise and innovate so the industry can be more profitable going forward. There is no silver bullet to fix the current situation TVNZ and Warner Brothers Discovery are facing at the moment. There is a process underway, and I'll have more to say when that process has concluded.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister think she has the confidence of the media sector? And if so, what does she say to former TVNZ boss and TV3 political editor Bill Ralston, who I quote, said the Minister has no idea what she is doing?
I can say that the sector can have confidence in the government who actually listen to the people. I take no pleasure in the situation happening in Warner Brothers and Discovery and TVNZ. There are challenges across the sector, like in many other parts of New Zealand economy, due to the cost of living crisis. I'm committed to working with the sector to support them to modernise and innovate so they can be more commercially viable. There is a process underway, and I will have more to say once that process has concluded.
Mr. Speaker, who is correct? The former TV3 head of news, Mark Jennings, who said the Minister, Melissa Lee, is all at sea and appears to have no vision at all, or the very respected News Talk ZB presenter, Heather Duplessis-Allen, who said the Minister is weird and shady?
No, perhaps not. Another question?
You want?
Okay, Mr. Speaker. Is it the case that actually the Minister has no plan? No one supports or believes her, and she has to wait until Winston Peters gets back to do her job for her?
You can answer one part of that multi-legged question.
No. I have no responsibility for that member's comments as well.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister really have confidence in continuing in the job, given the fact that she has confessed to being boring, inarticulate, and not a magician?
No, that's not reasonable. Try again. Try again. Hang on, just a minute. The member knows that personal reflections aren't the way in which we operate in this House. If you want to ask, without losing any of your allocation, you want to ask a different question.
Mr. Speaker, these are quotes from her.
Yeah, well, they may be, but they're still presented in a manner that is reflective of an individual, which we don't do in this House. So would you like to ask another question? Well, are you sure? Yeah, but he's just a minute. He's sort of run out of broadcast. So anyway, we'll move to question number 8, in the name of Dr. Lawrence Yunnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Education, Partnership Schools. Does he agree with the Public Health Communication Centre Aotearoa report on Ka'ora Ka'ako that the evidence is clear? Ka'ora Ka'ako alleviates hunger, and less hunger improves school achievement. If not, why not?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Brooke Van Velden.
On behalf of the Associate Minister of Education, I haven't reviewed the report in detail, but I can say that there are some benefits to the taxpayer-funded school lunch program, and that we will be funding for a revised program, something that the Labor government failed to fund beyond the end of the school year.
No need to reference any other party in regard to government policy. Dr. Lawrence Yunnan.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker. Can he guarantee that the quality, nutritional value, and the number of students receiving free lunches will not decline because of his cost-cutting measures?
On behalf of the Minister, the government is committed to looking at the evidence and improving the cost-effectiveness of the taxpayer-funded school lunch program after the previous government left it unfunded from 2024.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, stay on your feet, Dr. Lawrence Yunnan.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, you just mentioned before that the minister should not be attacking the previous government.
Yeah, that's. But you would have listened to me in the last few days, where it's not unreasonable for a minister to talk about a situation that has been inherited, and that's the minister did not step outside of that requirement. The Honourable Brooke Van Velden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the second point of the member's question, I think a lot of people see Ka'ora Ka'ako is a way of achieving other social goals, like improving nutrition. That well may be the case, but we don't fund the Ministry of Education for health reasons, just like we don't fund health for education reasons. This government is committed to ensuring that we are putting the policy with cost effectiveness into place.
Dr. Lawrence Yunnan, you get 3.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker. Does he agree then that we have a collective responsibility to ensure that no child goes hungry in Aotearoa?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's common sense, and multiple international evaluations tell us that students benefit from receiving food at school. But for the Ka'ora Ka'ako program itself, We have limited evidence of its impact on attendance and achievement. And it's very important for us as a government that we are focusing on attendance and achievement at the heart of our education policies.
Laura Truss.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What correspondence has he received on the program?
On behalf of the Minister, one teacher has told my office that, quote, only about 40% of the students take up the offer of a free lunch.
Just stop for a minute. Just stop. Let them. Yeah, good. Well, it only takes one person to walk out of here too, so please answer the question.
Thank you. Once again, on behalf of the Minister, one teacher has told my office that, quote, only about 40% of the students take up the offer of a free lunch, depending on what is on offer. The majority of what is taken ends up in the garbage. The college then gives away the remainder to local churches and the iwi. I agree that this needs to be targeted. Another correspondent has written that so much food is left over from one local school that some of it ends up as pig food.
Point of order, the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
I happen to have parliamentary practice in New Zealand with me.
Sorry, you're going to have to speak into your microphone. I didn't hear any of that.
And
points of order are heard in silence.
The member quoted from a piece of correspondence to the minister, and at paragraph 50.6.2, it makes clear that that correspondence is an official document. And even if she doesn't have it with her in the house, I would ask that she table it.
Well, you can ask all you like, but the House won't be doing that. So we'll move now to...
Speaking to the point of order.
Or are you speaking to your own point of order? I've ruled
well,
on it. Hang on, I have ruled on it. Well, a few times I have. Dr. Doran...
I seek leave for the Minister to table the correspondence that she has
mentioned. Wait a minute. Just a little bit of order. I know you get excited about these things. What do you want to do now? You say point of order.
Point of order.
And I say point of order, Carlos.
Thank you, Mr.
Ricardo Mendes-March.
Thank you very
and
much,
you
Mr.
Say,
Speaker. Thank you for recognising my eagerness. I seek leave for the Minister to table the correspondence she just quoted in the previous answer.
Well, are you seeking leave on behalf of another member? I don't think you are. So you're seeking leave on your own behalf?
I'm just seeking leave. Myself. I didn't believe that it needs to be the person asking the question who needs to seek leave.
I think that's quite how we can progress this one. But we'll call Dr. Lawrence Sunar.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
Doctor, please wait till we get a bit of quiet in the house. Okay, where you go?
If we're taking individual correspondence, what would the minister say to student Malachi Lafitta, who said the school lunch is mean, quote, students are a bit more active during class, they're healthier. I know some students who didn't come to school because they didn't want to, and the food has really given them a reason and has actually made them study.
On behalf of the minister, I thank the member for his question. We can also respond with equal evidence and correspondence from another relief teacher who said, and I quote, I'm a relief teacher at a low decile school in West Auckland, and I can assure you that less than half of the free government lunches are eaten by the children. They are regularly eaten by only about a quarter of most of the classes, and the rest are binned. Thank you.
Question.
Dr. Lawrence Sunan.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker. Then what does the minister say to the whānau of Akonga at Tikipunga Kura, who said if their tamariki could not access school lunches, that they would feel, quote, disheartened, as not all student whānau have the ability to provide lunches for their tamariki, end quote, and, quote, devastated because money is tight, end quote.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, what I would say to those people who have corresponded with that member is that this government is committed to the Ka Ora Ka Ako program. However, what we're committed to is cost effectiveness of the program. We shouldn't be looking at extending how much money we are spending, but we should be looking at making sure it's going to the right places.
Question number 10, in the name of the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Point of order.
Sorry. You're right, actually. I've just crossed something out too soon. Question number 9, Tim Costley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Transport, what recent announcements has he made on speed limits in Kapiti?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Great news. On Tuesday, I announced that NZTA has proposed to increase speed limits on Mackays to Peka Peka and Peka Peka to Otaki sections of the Kapiti Expressway to 110 kilometres per hour, with consultation on these changes beginning 22nd of April. This road of national significance, started by the previous national government, was designed to a safe standard suitable for 110 kilometres per hour and enabling these expressways to have the speed limit as part of this government's plan to speed up our economy.
Yeah. What reports has he seen on the safety benefits of the Kapiti Expressway?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this particular road, which is having a proposal to increase the speed limit to 110, is incredibly safe. Started by the last national government, designed and constructed to a high safety standard. Since the expressway opened, no one has died in a crash on this expressway, and there's been a 70% reduction in roads in the Kapiti district. The coalition government is committed to delivering safe and new roads of national significance across the country to get people and freight where they need to go quickly and safely.
How does the proposed change of speed limit on the Kapiti Expressway fit in with the government's plan to get New Zealand moving again?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the coalition government is stopping the previous government's blanket speed limit reductions and enabling new and existing roads of national significance to have speed limits of 110 kilometres per hour. Rather than forcing people to slow down, our plan ensures that when speed limits are set, economic impacts, including travel times and the views of road users and local communities, are taken into account alongside safety.
Question number 10, the name of the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Speaker, my question is to the Associate Minister of Justice for Firearms. Does she stand by all her statements and actions in respect of firearms reform?
Honourable Nicole McKee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, especially my statement regarding the fact that semi-automatic firearms were never banned under his government. The fact of the matter is that there are over 6,600 licensed firearm owners in New Zealand who have license endorsements which can allow them to possess a semi-automatic firearm. Mr. Speaker, semi-automatic firearms were never banned under that member's government. Many were merely transferred onto other firearm license endorsements, such as prohibited, pistol, and collector endorsements, among others.
Does she stand by her statement regarding reintroducing semi-automatic weapons like those used in the Christchurch mosque attack? I'm not reintroducing anything. Those firearms are already here. In fact, we have 6,600 people who have endorsements to be in possession of those firearms.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do stand by that statement.
Who is correct in relation to high-powered semi-automatic rifles? The police minister, when he said in response to written questions, as of 1 March 2024, there are 328 persons authorised to possess and use, including firing live ammunition, a prohibited firearm for the purposes of pest control. Or the minister, when she said we have 6,600 people who have endorsements to be in possession of those firearms.
Mr. Speaker, both those statements are correct, but the way that the member has asked the question, I think he needs to go and have a look at the difference between the endorsements and prohibited licences, because yes, there are 328 pest controllers out there, but there's also a large number of members of the licensed firearms community that can still use those prohibited firearms. Now, there is a difference between what Brenton Tarrant used and what is a centrefire semi-automatic, and I suggest if the member would like, I can give them some education and deferring and understanding what they both are.
Supplementary.
Dr. Webb.
Why did you say that currently over 6,600 New Zealanders are licensed to possess semi-automatic firearms when asked by Mark Cameron in this House on 27 February? Why did she say currently over 6,600 New Zealanders are licensed to possess semi-automatic firearms when asked by Mark Cameron in this House on 27 February 2024, when asked, will her government allow competitive shooters to use semi-automatics for sporting purposes, when the question was clearly referring to high-powered semi-automatic rifles, which are prohibited for such events?
Mr. Well, Speaker, I'm very confused by that question. For one, there's no such thing as a high-powered semi-automatic. We have rimfire, we've got centrefire. And if I may, Mr. Speaker, all firearms that are in the wrong hands of the wrong people can actually make damaging and catastrophic effects. But I just kind of, I wonder, I'm more than happy to sit with the member and work through so that he understands the differences between our different endorsements, as prohibited, restricted and endorsements.
Mark Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What comments has she seen from the Police Association?
Mr. Speaker, I did see a comment from Mr. Cahill that read, quote, she is using these figures to try and suggest that semi-automatic firearms are already widely available when they're not, end quote. I would suggest that Mr. Cahill cease trying to mislead the public. After working adjacent to the firearms community for many years, he will be well aware that semi-automatic firearms can be owned on a number of licence types and licence endorsements.
Scott Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What sport does the Minister believe centrefire semi-automatic firearms are suitable for?
Mr. Speaker, my personal opinion on what I have not taken to Cabinet yet is not a discussion for the House at this stage. When it comes to looking at whether or not there will be an addition to the already sporting exemption that we have for some users of such as pistols, for example, it needs to be a decision that is made by Cabinet. As yet, I've not had advice on that position, and I'm not ready to take that position to Cabinet.
Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. Does she stand by her statement, quote, this government is the adult in the room and we are committed to finding a solution to this issue for the benefit of public safety and practical regulation?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely. We are definitely the adult in the room. And in the 2018-19 year, there were 2,076 conviction charges for firearm-related offences. But in the 2022-2023 year, this has increased to 2,588. Mr. Speaker, this is a 24% increase. New Zealanders have not been made safer by the rushed firearm laws, and this government is wholly committed to righting the wrongs for the past for the benefit of public safety and practical regulation.
Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does she agree with Tom Mauser, whose son was killed in the Columbine school shooting, when speaking of semi-automatics being used for sport shooting? I understand that there are people who have fun firing these weapons, but we have to get beyond fun and we really have to consider the danger. If so, why is she distracting from the debate on the danger of semi-automatics by suggesting they're more widely available than they really are?
Mr. Speaker, my sympathies go out to all of the families that have been affected by the Columbine shooting. But it is of an important note that we are not America. We do not have their laws. And our laws and legislation will be relative to what we have here in New Zealand and the use of those firearms.
Question number 11, Tom Rutherford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing, Social Housing. What recent announcements has the government made about emergency housing?
Strong start. It is calamitous to see so many whānau in emergency housing, and we've recently announced a target of 75% reduction of the number of households in emergency housing by 2030. We want emergency housing, motels and other accommodation to be a last resort for a short period of time for those in genuine need.
Supplementary. How realistic is the 75% reduction in emergency housing?
Mr. Speaker, it's Māori Te Whare. The target is deliberately ambitious.
That's right.
We want whānau and tamariki to have safe, warm nice homes. Emergency housing should be a last resort for a short period of time for those that genuinely need it. The mahi is not a quick fix. It's hard mahi. It requires sustained and coordinated effort, something that in our role as the Kāwanatanga, as their government, we are committed to do. And setting a target, rather than talk, focuses attention.
Supplementary. What are the kinds of things the Minister will be doing to meet this target?
It's māngo and te whare. Tamariki a big focus. No one wants to see tamariki our children growing up in these motels. And the Kāwanatanga has announced a priority one category for whānau with tamariki who have been in emergency housing for 12 weeks or more, prioritising them on the social housing register. As my learned sentinel, the Honourable Chris Bishop, has most recently said, to end New Zealand's cataclysmic housing crisis, we need to use many tools to increase housing supply and to enable more homes and houses for all New Zealanders.
Supplementary. Why is there a target for emergency housing and not another part of the housing system?
Mr. Speaker, emergency housing as a basis of a target is the basis of a target because that's where we think we can have a significant impact on vulnerable New Zealanders. Long-term, large-scale use of emergency housing is a social, moral and cultural catastrophe. We can make impact right now by prioritising tamariki and emergency housing. Like a mother and her three tamariki who moved into a home in Tūranga Nui Akiwa recently and who said, at one stage we were all living in a tent in a friend's backyard. That's where we were when Cyclone Gabrielle struck. And that backyard got flooded. I've been grateful to have a roof over our heads, even though it has been very cramped and restrictive. Four of us living in a small bedroom in a studio has been challenging. Kia kaha tātou. Māori ora.
Question number 12, in the name of Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Veterans Affairs. Does he agree with the RSA National President, Sir Wayne Shelford, that New Zealand has legislation that is discriminatory and inadequately provides for New Zealand veterans of military service?
The Honourable Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On behalf of the Minister for Veteran Affairs, I want to thank the member for his question, and I also want to acknowledge all those who have served in New Zealand Defence Forces. I agree that there are improvements which can be made so we can provide more support for veterans. I would like to acknowledge the Royal New Zealand RSA for their consistent advocacy for veterans in New Zealand.
A supplementary question. What will the Minister, given it is 2 weeks until Anzac Day, be telling those veterans who have been removed from the waiting list for VIP services?
Well, first of all, I dispute the premise of that question. What has happened is that all those who have served, the Chief of Defence has reallocated the staff to process the unacceptable backlog of health claims for those veterans with medical conditions associated with their service. And the reason he has done that is the dreadful legacy that the previous government has left us to deal with, because it's taking up to 361 days to process these medical claims, and it is an outrageous situation for New Zealand veterans.
Does the Minister accept that less services will be available to veterans now as a result of the decision not to proceed with the applications of those on the waiting list?
I dispute the claim that there will be less services available.
Uh, Is the Minister prepared to guarantee funding to the RSA to provide the services currently provided by the Veterans Independence Program?
In terms of funding, the veterans at the moment receive about $131 million for covering pension costs, and there's another $30 million for administering the schemes, including the VIP scheme that the member talks about. That funding is something that's under review in terms of whether that could be increased, but that level of funding is something that keeps and supports New Zealand veterans, and it is rightly so.
That concludes oral questions.